deep breath, praying I hadn't got this all wrong, and said, "You would have suspected that Jenny Hobbs and Nancy Duquesne were colluding to deceive us."
"Quite correct, mon ami."
Poirot beamed at me. To our audience, he said, "Shortly before I tasted the coffee and made the connection with Plaisance, I had been looking at a picture by St. John Wallace that was his wedding anniversary present to his wife. It was a picture of blue bindweed. It was dated the 4th of August last year, and Lady Wallace remarked upon this." It was then that, Poirot, he realized something. Nancy Duquesne's portrait of Louisa Wallace, which he had seen a few minutes earlier, was not dated. As an appreciator of art, I have attended countless exhibition premieres in London. I have seen the work of Mrs. Duquesne before, many times. Her pictures always have the date in the bottom right-hand corner, as well as her initials, N-A-E-D.
"You pay more attention than most to attend the exhibitions," Nancy said.
"Hercule Poirot always pays attention to everything. I believe, madame, that your portrait of Louisa Wallace was dated until you painted out the date. Why? Because it was not a recent one. You needed me to believe that you had delivered the portrait to Lady Wallace on the night of the murders, and that therefore it was a newly completed portrait. I asked myself, why did you not paint on a new, false date? And the answer was obvious. If your work survives for hundreds of years, and if art historians take an interest in it, as they surely will, you do not wish actively to mislead them, these people who care about your work? No, the only people you wish to mislead are Hercule Poirot and the police." Nancy Duquesne tilted her head to one side. In a thoughtful voice, she said,
"How perceptive you are, Monsieur Poirot. You really do understand, don't you?"
"Oui, madame. I understand that you found employment for Jenny Hobbs in the home of your friend Louisa Wallace to help Jenny when she came to London and needed a job. I understand that Jenny was never part of any plan to frame you for murder, though she allowed Richard Negus to believe otherwise. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, Jenny Hobbs and Nancy Duquesne have been friends and allies ever since they both lived in Great Holling. The two women who loved Patrick Ive unconditionally and beyond reason are the ones who formulated a plan nearly clever enough to fool me, Hercule Poirot, but not quite clever enough."
"Lies! All lies!"
Jenny wept. Nancy said nothing. Poirot said,
"Let me return for a moment to the home of the Wallaces. In Nancy Duquesne's portrait of Lady Louisa, that I inspected so closely and for so long, there is a blue jug and bowl set. When I walked up and down the room and looked at it in different lights, the blue of the jug and the bowl remained a solid block of color, bland and uninteresting. Every other color on that canvas changed subtly as I moved around, depending on the light. Nancy Duquesne is a sophisticated artist. She is a genius when it comes to color. Except when she is in a hurry and thinking not about art, but about protecting herself and her friend Jenny Hobbs, to conceal information. Nancy quickly painted blue a jug and bowl set that were not formerly blue.
Why did she do this? To paint out the date, I suggested.
No.
The jug and bowl were in the top half of the picture, and Nancy Duquesne always paints the date in the bottom right-hand corner, said Poirot.
Lady Wallace, you did not expect me to ask to be shown round your home from bottom to top? You thought that once we had spoken and I had seen Nancy Duquesne's portrait of you, I would be satisfied and leave. But I wanted to see if I could find this blue jug and bowl that were in the portrait, and painted with so much less subtlety than the rest of the picture. And I did find them. Lady Wallace seemed to be puzzled because they were missing, but her puzzlement was a pretense. In an upstairs bedroom, there was a white jug and bowl set with a crest on it. This, I thought, might be the jug and bowl set in the portrait, yet it was not blue. Mademoiselle Dorcas, Lady Wallace told me that you must have smashed or stolen the blue jug and bowl.
I never did, said a stricken Dorcas. I ain't never seen no blue jug and bowl in the house.
Because, young lady, there has never been one there, said Poirot. Why, I asked myself, would Nancy Duquesne hurriedly paint over the white jug and bowl with blue paint? What did she hope to hide? It had surely to be the crest, I concluded. Crests are not purely decorative. They belong to families, sometimes or at other times to colleges of famous universities.
Saviour College, Cambridge, I said before I could stop myself. I remembered that just before Poirot and I had left London for Great Holling, Stanley Beer had referred to a crest.
Oui, Catchpool. When I left the Wallace's home, I drew a picture of the crest so that I would not forget it. I am no artist, but it was accurate enough. I asked Constable Beer to find out for me where it came from. As you have all heard my friend Catchpool say, the crest on the white jug and bowl set in the Wallace's house is that of Saviour College, Cambridge, where Jenny Obbs used to work as a bedmaker for the Reverend Patrick Ive. It was a living present to you, was it not, Miss Obbs, when you left Saviour College and went to Great Olling with Patrick and Francis Ive? And then, when you moved into the home of Lord and Lady Wallace, you took it with you. When you left that house in a hurry and went to hide at Mr. Kidd's house, you did not take the jug and bowl. You are in no state of mind to think of such things. I believe that Louisa Wallace, at that point, moved the jug and bowl set from the servants' quarters you had previously occupied into a guest bedroom, where it might be admired by those she wished to impress. Jenny didn't answer. Her face was blank and expressionless.
Nancy Duquesne did not want to take even the tiniest risk, said Poirot. She knew that after the murders in this hotel, Catchpool and I would ask questions in the village of Great Holling. What if the old drunkard, Walter Stokely, formerly master of Saviour College, mentioned to us that he gave Jenny Hobbs a crested jug and bowl as a living present? If we then saw a crest in the portrait of Lady Louisa Wallace, we might discover the connection to Jenny Hobbs, and by extension, the link between Nancy Duquesne and Jenny Hobbs, which was not one of enmity and envy, as we had been told by both women, but one of friendship and collusion. Madame Duquesne could not take the chance that we would arrive at this suspicion because of the crest in the portrait, and so the white jug and bowl set was painted blue, hurriedly and with little artistry.
Not all of one's work can be one's best work, Monsieur Poirot, said Nancy.
It alarmed me to hear how reasonable she sounded, to see somebody who had conspired in 3 unlawful killings being so polite and rational in conversation.
"Perhaps you would agree with Mrs. Duquesne, Lord Wallace," said Poirot.
"You too are a painter, though of a very different kind. Ladies and gentlemen, St. John Wallace is a botanical artist. I saw his work in every room of his house when I visited. Lady Louisa was gracious enough to show me around, just as she was generous enough to provide a false alibi for Nancy Duquesne. Lady Louisa, you see, is a good woman. She is the most dangerous kind of good, so far removed from evil that she does not notice it when it is right in front of her. Lady Wallace believed in Nancy Duquesne's innocence and provided an alibi to protect her. Oh, the lovely, talented Nancy. She is most convincing. She convinced St. John Wallace that she was eager to try her hand at his sort of painting. Lord Wallace is well-connected and well-known, therefore easily able to obtain what plants he needs for his work. Nancy Duquesne asked him to obtain for her some cassava plants, from which the cyanide is made.
How the devil can you possibly know that?
St. John Wallace demanded.
A lucky guess, monsieur. Nancy Duquesne told you that she wanted these plants for the purpose of her art, did she not? And you believed her.
To the sea of open-mouthed faces, Poirot said,
"The truth is that neither Lord nor Lady Wallace would ever believe a good friend of theirs capable of murder. It would reflect so badly upon them. Their social standing, imagine it! Even now, when everything I say fits perfectly with what they know to be true, St. John and Louisa Wallace tell themselves that he must be wrong, this opinionated detective from the continent. Such is the perversity of the human mind, particularly where snobbish idée fixe are concerned."
"Monsieur Poirot, I have not killed anyone," said Nancy Duquesne. "I know that you know I am telling the truth. Please make it clear to everybody gathered in this room that I am not a murderer."
"I cannot do that, madame. Je suis désolé. You did not administer the poison yourself, but you conspired to end 3 lives."
"Yes, but only to save another," said Nancy earnestly. "I am guilty of nothing. Come, Jenny, let us tell him our story, the true story. Once he has heard it, he will have to concede that we did only what we had to do to save our own lives."
The room was completely still. Everyone sat in silence. I did not think Jenny was going to move, but eventually, slowly, she rose to her feet. Clutching her bag in front of her with both hands, she walked across the room towards Nancy.
"Our lives were not worth saving," she said.
"Jenny!"
Sam Kidd cried out, and suddenly he too was out of his chair and moving towards her. As I watched him, I had the peculiar sense of time having slowed down. Why was Kidd running? What was the danger? He clearly thought there was one, and though I did not understand why, my heart had started to beat hard and fast. Something terrible was about to happen. I started to run towards Jenny. She opened her bag.
"So you want to be reunited with Patrick, do you?" she said to Nancy.
I recognized the voice as hers, but at the same time it was not hers. It was the sound of unremitting darkness moulded into words. I hope never again to hear anything like it as long as I live. Poirot had also started to move, but both of us were too far away.
"Poirot!"
I called, and then, "Someone stop her!" I saw metal and light dancing upon it. Two men at the table next to Nancy's rose to their feet, but they were not moving fast enough.
No!
I called out. There was a rapid movement, Jenny's hand, and then blood, a rush of it, flowing down Nancy's dress and onto the floor. Nancy fell to the ground. Somewhere at the back of the room, a woman started to scream. Poirot had stopped moving and now stood perfectly still.
Mon Dieu, he said, and closed his eyes.
Samuel Kidd reached Nancy before I could.
She's dead, he said, staring down at her body on the floor.
Yes, she is, said Jenny. I stabbed her in the heart. Right in the heart.
Chapter 25. If Murder Began with a D. I learned that day that I am not afraid of death. It is a state that contains no energy. It exerts no force. I see dead bodies in the course of my work, and it has never bothered me unduly. No. The thing I dread above all else is proximity to death in the living. The sound of Jenny Hobbs's voice, when the desire to kill has consumed her, the state of mind of a murderer who would, with cold calculation, put three monogrammed cufflinks in his victim's mouths and take the trouble to lay them out, straightening their limbs and their fingers, placing their lifeless hands palms downward on the floor. Hold his hand, Edward. How can the living hold the hands of the dying and not fear being pulled towards death themselves? If I had my way, no person, while alive and vital, would have any involvement with death at all. I accept that this is an unrealistic hope. After she had stabbed Nancy, I did not wish to be near Jenny Hobbs. I was not curious to learn why she had done it. I simply wanted to go home, sit by one of Blanche Unsworth's roaring fires, work on my crossword puzzle, and forget all about the Bloxham Hotel murders, or monogram murders, or whatever anybody wanted to call them. Poirot, however, had enough curiosity for both of us, and his will was stronger than mine. He insisted that I stay. This was my case, he said. I had to tie it up neatly. He made a gesture with his hands that suggested meticulous wrapping, as if a murder investigation were a parcel. So it was that several hours later, he and I were seated in a small, square room at Scotland Yard, with Jenny Hobbs across the table from us. Samuel Kidd had also been arrested, and was being questioned by Stanley Beer. I would have given anything to tackle Kidd instead, who was a crook and a rotten egg for sure, but in whose voice I had never heard the extinction of all hope. On the subject of voices, I was surprised by the gentleness of Poirot's as he spoke. "Why did you do it, mademoiselle? Why kill Nancy Duquesne, when the two of you have been friends and allies for so long?"
"Nancy and Patrick were lovers in every sense of the word. I did not know that until I heard her say so today. I always thought she and I were the same. We both loved Patrick, but knew we could not be with him in that way. Had not been with him in that way. All these years I have believed that their love was chaste. But that was a lie. If Nancy had really loved Patrick, she would not have made an adulterer of him and sullied his moral character."
Jenny wiped away a tear.
"I believe I did her a favour. You heard her express the desire to be reunited with Patrick. I helped her with that, didn't I?"
"Catchpool," said Poirot. "Do you recall that I said to you, after we found the blood in the room 402 of the Bloxham Hotel, that it was too late for me to save Mademoiselle Jenny?"
"Yes." "You thought I meant that she was dead, but you misunderstood me. You see,
I knew even then that Jenny was beyond help. She had already done things so terrible that her own death was guaranteed, I feared. That was my meaning.
In every way that counts, I have been dead since Patrick died,
Jenny said in that same tone of unending hopelessness. I knew there was only one way that I could get through this ordeal, and that was by concentrating all my attention on questions of logic.
Had Poirot solved the puzzle?
He seemed to think he had, but I was still in the dark. Who, for instance, had killed Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury, and Richard Negus, and why had they done so? I asked these questions of Poirot.
Ah, he said, smiling fondly, as if I had reminded him of a joke we had once shared.
I see your dilemma, mon ami.
You listen to Poirot declaim at great length, and then, a few minutes before the conclusion, there is the interruption of another murder. And you do not, after all, hear the answers that you have been waiting for.
Dommage.
Please tell me at once, and let the dommage end here, I said as forcefully as I could.
It is quite simple. Jenny Obbs and Nancy Duquesne, with the help of Samuel Kidd, conspired to murder Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury, and Richard Negus. However, while collaborating with Nancy, Jenny pretended to be part of a quite different conspiracy. She allowed Richard Negus to believe that he was the one with whom she conspired.
That does not sound quite simple to me, I said. It sounds inordinately complicated.
No, no, my friend. Vraiment, it is not at all. You are having trouble reconciling the different versions of the story that you have heard. But you must forget all that Jenny told us when we visited her at Samuel Kidd's house. Banish it from your mind completely. It was a lie from start to finish, though I do not doubt it contained some elements of veracity. The best lies always do.
In a moment, Jenny will tell us the whole truth, now that she has nothing to lose. But first, my friend, I must pay you the compliment that you deserve. It was you, in the end, who helped me to see clearly with your suggestion in the graveyard of Holy Saints Church.
Poirot turned to Jenny. He said,
"The lie you told to Harriet Sipple, that Patrick Ive took money from parishioners and, in return, conveyed to them messages from their dead loved ones, that Nancy Duquesne had visited him in the vicarage at night for that reason, in the hope of communicating with her deceased husband, William. How often has Poirot heard about this terrible, wicked lie? Many, many times. You yourself admitted to us the other day, Miss Obbs, that you told the lie in a moment of weakness inspired by jealousy. But this was not the truth.
Standing by Patrick and Francis Ives' desecrated grave, Catchpole said to me,
"What if Jenny Obbs lied about Patrick Ive not to hurt him, but to help him?"
Catchpole had realized the significance of something that I had taken for granted, a fact that had never been in dispute, and so I had failed to examine it. Harriet Sipple's passionate love for her late husband George, who died tragically young.
Had Poirot not been told how much Harriet had loved George, or how the death of George had turned Harriet from a happy, warm-hearted woman into a bitter, spiteful monster? One can hardly imagine a loss so terrible, so devastating, that it extinguishes all joy and destroys all that is good in a person. Oui, bien sûr. I knew that Harriet Sipple had suffered such a loss. I knew it so surely that I thought no further about it.
I knew also that Jenny Hobbs loved Patrick Ive enough to abandon Samuel Kidd, her fiancé, in order to remain in the service of Reverend Ive and his wife. This is a very self-sacrificing love, content to serve and receive little in return. Yet the story told to us by both Jenny and Nancy offered Jenny's jealousy as her reason for telling the terrible lie that she told, jealousy of Patrick's love for Nancy. But this cannot be true. It is not consistent. We must think not only of the physical facts, but of the psychological. Jenny did nothing to punish Patrick Ive for his marriage to Frances. She accepted with good grace that he belonged to another woman. She continued as his loyal servant and was a great help to him and his wife at the vicarage, and they, in turn, were devoted to her. Why, then, all of a sudden, after many years of self-sacrificing love and selfies, would Patrick Ives' love for Nancy Duquesne inspire Jenny to slander him and to set in motion a chain of events that would destroy him? The answer is that it would not, and it did not. It was not the eruption of envy and longing locked inside for so long that prompted Jenny to tell her lie. It was something altogether different. You were trying, were you not, Miss Hobbs, to help the man you loved, to save him, even. As soon as I heard the theory of my clever friend Catchpole, I knew it was the truth. It was so obvious, and Poirot, he had been imbecile not to see. Jenny looked at me. What theory? She asked. I opened my mouth to answer, but Poirot was too quick for me. When Harriet Sipple told you she had seen Nancy Duquesne visiting the vicarage late at night, you were straight away alert to the danger. You knew about these trysts. How could you not, when you lived at the vicarage, and you were anxious to protect Patrick Ives' good name? How could this be achieved? Harriet Sipple, when she had sniffed out a scandal, would relish the opportunity to bring public shame to a sinner. How could you explain the presence of Nancy Duquesne at the vicarage on nights when Francis Ive was not there, except with the truth? What other story would pass the muster? And then, as if by magic, when you had almost given up hope, you thought of something that might work. You decided to use temptation and false hope to eliminate the threat that Harriet represented. Jenny stared blankly ahead. She said nothing. Harriet Sipple and Nancy Duquesne had something in common, Poirot went on. They had both lost their husbands to early tragic death. You told Harriet that with the help of Patrick Ive, Nancy had been able to communicate with the deceased William Duquesne, that money had changed hands. Of course, it would have to be kept secret from the church and from everybody in the village, but you suggested to Harriet that if she so wished, Patrick would be able to do for her what he was doing for Nancy. She and Josh could be, if not together again, then at least there could be a communication of a kind between them. Tell me, how did Harriet respond when you said this to her? A long silence followed. Then Jenny said, she was foaming at the mouth for it to happen as soon as possible. She would pay any price, she said, to be able to speak to George again. You cannot imagine how much she loved that man, Monsieur Poirot. Watching her face as I spoke, it was like seeing a dead woman come back to life. I tried to explain it all to Patrick, that there had been a problem, but I had solved it. I made the offer to Harriet without asking him first, you see. Oh,
think I knew in my heart that Patrick would never consent to it, but I was desperate. I didn't want to give him the chance to forbid me. Can you understand that?
Oui, mademoiselle.
I hoped I would be able to persuade him to agree. He was a principled man, but I knew he would want to shield Francis from a scandal and protect Nancy, and this was a certain way to guarantee Harriet's silence. It was the only way.
All Patrick would have had to do was say some comforting words to Harriet once in a while and pretend that those words came from George Sipple.
There was no need for him to take her money, even. I said all this to him, but he wouldn't hear of it. He was horrified.
"You was entirely right to be," said Poirot quietly. "Continue, please."
He said it would be immoral and unfair to do to Harriet what I was proposing. He would sooner face personal ruin. And I begged him to reconsider. What harm would it do if it would make Harriet happy? But Patrick was resolute. He asked me to give her the message that what I had proposed would not, after all, be possible. He was very specific. "Do not say that you lied, Jenny, or else you will revert to suspecting the truth," he said. My instructions were to tell Harriet only that she could not have what she wanted.
"So you had no choice but to tell her," I said.
"No choice at all."
Jenny started to cry.
"And from the moment I told Harriet that Patrick had refused her request, she made herself his enemy, repeating my lie to the whole village. Patrick could have ruined her reputation in return by making it known that she had been eager to avail herself of his unwholesome services, and only started to call them blasphemous and unchristian once she had been thwarted. But he wouldn't do it. He said that no matter how maliciously Harriet attacked him, he would not blacken her name. Foolish man! He could have shut her up in an instant, but he was too noble for his own good.
Was that when you went to Nancy Duquesne for advice? Poirot asked.
Yes. I didn't see why Patrick and I should be the only ones to fret. Nancy was part of it too. I asked her if I should publicly admit to my lie, but she advised me not to. She said, "I fear that trouble is coming to Patrick now, one way or another, and to me. You would be wise to recede into the background and say nothing, Jenny. Do not sacrifice yourself. I am not sure you would be strong enough to withstand Harriet's vilification." She underestimated me. I was upset, you see. I suppose I sort of fell apart a bit, because I was so frightened for Patrick, with Harriet determined to destroy him. But I am not a weak person, Monsieur Poirot.
I see that you are not afraid.
No. I draw strength from the knowledge that Harriet Sipple, that loathsome hypocrite, is dead. Her killer did the world a great service.
Which leads us to the question of that killer's identity, mademoiselle. Who killed Harriet Sipple? You told us that it was Ida Gronsberry, but that was a lie.
I hardly need to tell you the truth, Monsieur Poirot, when you know it as well as I do.
Then I must ask you to take pity on poor Mr. Catchpole here. He does not yet know the whole story.
You'd better tell him, then, hadn't you?
Jenny smiled, an absent sort of smile, and I suddenly felt as if there was less of her in the room than there had been only moments ago. She had taken herself away.
"Très bien," said Poirot. "I will start with Harriet Sipple and Ida Gronsberry. Two inflexible women, so convinced of their own rectitude that they were willing to hound a good man into an early grave. Did they express sorrow after his death? No. Instead, they objected to his burial in consecrated ground. Did these two women, after much persuasion by Richard Negus, come to regret their treatment of Patrick Ive? No, of course they did not. It is not plausible that they would. That, Mademoiselle Jenny, was when I knew that you were lying, at that point in your story.
Jenny shrugged. Anything is possible, she said.
No, only the truth is possible. I knew that Harriet Sipple and Ida Gransberry would never have agreed to the plan of voluntary execution that you described to me. Therefore, they were murdered. How convenient to pass off their murders as a kind of delegated suicide. You hoped Poirot might disengage his little grey cells once he heard that all the dead had been so willing to die. It was their great opportunity for redemption. What an imaginative and unusual story. The sort that one hears and assumes must be the truth. For who would think to invent such a fabrication?
It was my safeguard to be used if needed, said Jenny. I hoped you would never find me, but I feared you might.
And if I did, you expected that your alibi for between 7:15 and 8:10 would work, and Nancy Duquesne's also. You and Samuel Kidd would be charged with attempting to frame an innocent woman, but not with murder or conspiracy to commit murder. It is clever. You confess to wrongdoing in order to avoid punishment for far more serious crimes. Your enemies are murdered, and no one hangs because we believe your story. Ida Gransberry killed Harriet Sipple, and Richard Negus killed Ida Gransberry, and then himself. Your plan was ingenious, mademoiselle, but not as ingenious as Hercule Poirot.
Richard wanted to die, said Jenny angrily. He was not murdered. He was determined to die.
Yes, said Poirot. This was the truth in the lie.
It's his fault, the whole horrible mess. I would never have killed anybody if it were not for Richard.
But you did kill several times.
It was Catchpole who, once again, set me on the right track by uttering a few innocent words.
What words? Jenny asked.
He said, if murder began with a D. It was unsettling to listen to Poirot's appreciation of my helpfulness. I didn't understand how a few careless words of mine could have been so momentous. Poirot was in full flow. After we had heard your story, mademoiselle, we left Samuel Kidd's house and, naturally, we discussed what you had told us. Your supposed plan that you made together with Richard Negus. If I may say so, it was a compelling idea. There was a neatness about it, like the falling dominoes. Except, when I thought carefully, it was not like that at all, because the order of knocking over is altered. Not D falls down, then C, then B, then A. Instead, B knocks down A, and then C knocks down B. But that is beside the point. What on earth was he talking about? Jenny looked as if she was wondering the same thing. Ah, I must be more lucid in my explanation, said Poirot. To enable myself to imagine the order of events more easily, mademoiselle, I substituted letters for names. Your plan, as you told it to us at Samuel Kidd's house, was as follows. B kills A, C then kills B, D then kills C. Afterwards, D waits for E to be blamed and hanged for the murders of A, B, and C, and then D kills herself. Do you see, Miss Hobbs, that you are D in this arrangement, according to the story you told us?
Jenny nodded.
Bon. Now, by chance, Catchpool here is a devotee of the crossword puzzle. And it was in connection with this hobby that he asked me to think of a word that had six letters and meant death. I suggested murder. No, said Catchpool. My suggestion would only work if murder began with a D. I recalled his words some time later and made the idle speculation in my mind. What if murder did begin with a D? What if the first to kill was not Ida Gronsberry, but you, Miss Hobbs? Over time, this speculation hardened into certainty. I understood why it must have been you who killed Harriet Sipple. She and Ida Gronsberry shared neither a train nor a car from Great Holling to the Bloxham Hotel. Therefore, each was unaware of the presence of the other, and there was no plan agreed by all for one to kill the other. That had to be a lie.
What was the truth? I asked rather desperately.
Harriet Sipple believed, and so did Ida Gronsberry, that she alone was going to London for a very private reason. Harriet had been contacted by Jenny, who said she needed to meet with her urgently. The highest level of secrecy was required. Jenny told Harriet that a room at the Bloxham Hotel was booked and paid for, and that she, Jenny, would come to the hotel on Thursday afternoon, perhaps at 3:30 or 4:00, so that they could conduct their important business. Harriet accepted Jenny's invitation, because Jenny had written in her letter of invitation something that Harriet could not resist. You offered her what Patrick Ive had refused her all those years ago, n'est-ce pas, mademoiselle? Communication with her late beloved husband. You told her that George Sipple had sought to speak to her through you. You, who had tried to help him reach her 16 years earlier and failed. And now again, George was trying to send a message to his dearest wife using you as his channel. He had spoken to you from the afterlife. Ho, ho, I have no doubt that you made it extremely convincing. Harriet was unable to resist. She believed because she so ardently wished it to be true. The lie that you had told her so long ago about the souls of the dead loved ones making contact with the living, she believed it then, and she had never stopped believing it.
Clever old you, Monsieur Poirot, said Jenny. Top marks.
Catchpool, tell me, do you understand now about the old woman enamored of a man possibly young enough to be her son? These people with whom you became so obsessed, who featured in the gossip between Nancy Duquesne and Samuel Kidd in room 317?
I'd hardly say obsessed. And no, I don't understand.
Let us recall précisément what Raphael Bobak told us. He heard Nancy Duquesne, posing as Harriet Sipple, say, "She's no longer the one he confides in. He'd hardly be interested in her now. She's let herself go, and she's old enough to be his mother."
Think about those words.
He'd hardly be interested in her now. That fact is asserted first, before the two reasons for his lack of interest are given. One of these is that she is old enough to be his mother. Now she is old enough to be his mother. Do you not see, Catchpool? If she is old enough to be his mother now, then she must always have been old enough to be his mother. Nothing else is possible.
Isn't that stretching it a bit? I said. I mean, without the now, it makes perfect sense. He'd hardly be interested in her. She's let herself go, and she's old enough to be his mother.
But, mon ami, what you say, it is ridiculous.
Poirot spluttered.
It is not logical. The now was there, in the sentence. We cannot pretend to be without it when we are with it. We cannot ignore a now that is right in front of our ears.
I'm afraid I disagree with you, I said with some trepidation. If I had to guess, I should say that the intended meaning was something along these lines. Before she let herself go, this chap didn't especially mind or notice the age difference between them. Maybe it wasn't quite so visible. However, now that she is no longer in tip-top shape, the chap has moved on to a younger, more attractive companion, the one he now confides in. Poirot had begun to speak over me, red-faced and impatient.
There is no point in you guessing, Catchpole, when I know. Listen to Poirot. Listen one more time to exactly what was said and in what order. He'd hardly be interested in her now. She's let herself go, and she's old enough to be his mother. Reason one, that he would no longer be interested in her, followed by reason two. The construction of the sentence makes it clear that both of these unfortunate circumstances that are the case now were once not the case.
There is no need to shout at me, Poirot. I have grasped your point, and I still disagree. Not everybody is as precise in their speech as you. My interpretation has to be the correct one, and yours incorrect, because, as you have pointed out, it makes no sense otherwise. You said it yourself. If she is old enough to be his mother now, then she must always have been old enough to be his mother.
Catchpole, Catchpole, how I begin to despair of you! Think of what came later in the conversation. Raphael Bobeck heard Samuel Kidd, posing as Richard Negus, say, I dispute the old enough to be his mother claim. I dispute it utterly. To which Nancy, posing as Harriet, replied, Well, neither of us can prove we are right, so let's agree to disagree. But why could neither prove they were right? Surely it is a matter of simple biological fact, whether or not a woman is old enough to be a man's mother. If she is 4 years older than him, then she is not old enough. No one would dispute this. If she is 20 years older, then she is old enough to be his mother. That is equally certain.
What if she were 13 years older? Said Jenny Hobbs, who had closed her eyes. Or 12? One does hear of rare cases. That does not apply here, of course.
So Jenny knew where Poirot was going with all this. I was the only ignorant one in the room.
13, 12, it is irrelevant. One asks a doctor, a medical expert, is it theoretically possible for a female of 13 or 12 to give birth to a child? The answer is either yes or no. Please, let us not debate the borderline cases of potential childbearing ages.
Have you forgotten the other intriguing statement made by Samuel Kidd in connection with this allegedly younger man? His mind? I'd argue he has no mind.
No doubt you will say that Mr. Kidd meant nothing more than that the man in question was an imbecile.
No doubt I will, I said peevishly. Why don't you tell me what I'm missing, since you're so much cleverer than I am?
Poirot made a dismissive clicking noise. Sacré tonnerre. The couple under discussion in room 317 were Harriet Sipple and her husband, George. The conversation was not a serious debate. It was mockery. George Sipple died when he and Harriet were both very young. Samuel Kidd argues that he has no mind, because if George Sipple exists at all after his death, It is not in human form. He is a ghost, n'est-ce pas? Since the mind is inside the brain, and the soul does not possess human organs, George Cipel, the ghost, cannot have a mind.
I...
Oh, heavens. Yes. Now I see. Samuel Kidd introduces his point of view in the way that he does.
I would argue.
Because he expects Nancy Duquesne to disagree.
She might well have said, of course, a ghost must have a mind. Ghosts have agency, do they not, and free will. From where do these things come, if not the mind?
Philosophically, it was an interesting point. In different circumstances, I could imagine taking a view on the matter myself.
Poirot continued.
Nancy's old enough to be his mother remark was based on her belief that when a man dies, his age is then fixed forevermore. In the afterlife, he does not age. Georges Cipel, if he were to return as a spirit to visit his widow, would be a young man in his 20s, the age he was when he died. And she, as a woman in her 40s, is now old enough to be his mother.
Bravo, said Jenny in a matter-of-fact tone of voice.
I was not there, but the conversation was continued later in my presence.
Monsieur Poirot really is formidably perceptive, Mr. Catchpole. I hope you appreciate him.
To Poirot, she said,
The argument went on. Oh, just forever. Nancy insisted she was right, but Sam would not concede the point. He said ghosts do not exist in the dimension of age. They are timeless. So it is incorrect to say that anyone could be old enough to be a ghost's mother.
Poirot said to me,
It is distasteful, is it not, Catchpole?
When Raphael Bobac delivered the food, Nancy Duquesne, with the dead body of Ida Gransberry propped up in a chair beside her, was mocking the woman in whose murder she had conspired earlier that same day.
Poor stupid Harriet.
Her husband is not interested in talking directly to her from beyond the grave.
No. He will speak only to Jenny Hobbs, leaving Harriet with no choice if she wants to receive his message. She must meet Jenny at the Bloxham, and in doing so, meet her own doom.
Nobody has ever deserved to be murdered more than Harriet Cipel did, said Jenny. I have many regrets. Killing Harriet is not one of them.
What about Ida Gransberry? I asked. Why did she go to the Bloxham Hotel?
Ah,
said Poirot, who never tired of sharing the endless knowledge that he alone seemed to possess.
Ida also accepted an irresistible invitation from Richard Negus.
Not to be put in communication with a dead loved one, but to meet, after 16 years apart, her former fiancé. It is not hard to imagine what the lure would have been.
Richard Negus abandoned Ida and, no doubt, broke her heart. She never married. I expect he alluded in a letter to the possibility of a reconciliation. Maybe matrimony. A happy ending. Ida agreed. Which lonely individual would not choose to give a second chance to true love? And Richard told her that he would come to her room at the Bloxham Hotel at 3:30 or perhaps 4 o'clock on the Thursday.
Do you remember your remark, Catchpole, about arriving at the hotel on Wednesday so that the whole of Thursday could be devoted to getting murdered? That makes more sense now, yes?
I nodded.
Negus knew that on the Thursday he would have to commit murder, and also to be killed himself. It is only natural that he would wish to arrive a day early to prepare himself mentally for a double ordeal of that sort.
Also, to avoid the delayed train or something similar that might have interfered with his plans, said Poirot.
So Jenny Hobbs murdered Harriet Sipple, and Richard Negus murdered Ida Gransbury, I said.
Oh oui, mon ami.
Poirot looked at Jenny, who nodded. At around the same time of day, in rooms 121 and 317 respectively. In both rooms, the same method was used, I imagine, to induce Harriet and Ida to drink the poison. Jenny said to Harriet and Richard Negus to Ida, "You will need a glass of water before you hear what I have to say. Here, let me fetch one for you. You sit down." While fetching the water, using the glass next to the basin, Jenny and Negus slipped in the poison. The glasses were then handed to the two victims to drink. Death would have followed shortly thereafter.
What about Richard Negus's death? I asked.
Jenny killed him, according to the plan the two of them made.
Much of what I told you at Sam's house was true, said Jenny. Richard did write to me after years of silence. He was torn apart by guilt for what he had done to Patrick and Francis, and he saw no way out, no possibility of justice or peace of mind, unless we all paid with our own lives, all four of us who were responsible.
He asked you to help him kill Harriet and Ida, I said, working it out as I spoke.
Yes, them and him and myself as well. It had to be all of us, he insisted, or else it was meaningless. He did not want to be a murderer, but an executioner. He used that word a lot, and that meant that he and I could not avoid punishment. I agreed with him that Harriet and Ida deserved to die. They were evil. But I didn't want to die, nor did I want Richard dead. It was enough for me that he was truly sorry for his part in Patrick's death. I knew it would have been enough for Patrick, too, and for any higher authority that might or might not exist. But there was no way to persuade Richard of this. I saw at once that there was no point trying. He was as intelligent as he always had been, but something in his mind had slipped and turned him peculiar, given him weird ideas. All those years of brooding on it, the guilt. He had become a strange species of zealot. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that he would murder me, too, if I did not go along with what he was proposing. He didn't say so explicitly. He didn't want to threaten me, you see. He was kind to me. What he wanted and needed was an ally. Someone of like mind. He honestly believed I would agree to his scheme because, unlike Harriet and Ida, I was reasonable. He was so certain he was right, that his solution was the only way for all of us. I thought perhaps he was right. But I was afraid. I'm not anymore. I don't know what has changed me. Maybe then, even in my unhappiness, I still entertained the notion that my life might improve. Sadness is different from despair.
You knew that you would have to pretend in order to save your life, said Poirot. To lie convincingly to Richard Negus, it was your only possible escape from death. You did not know what to do, so you went to Nancy Duquesne for help.
Yes, I did. And she solved my problem. Or so I thought. Her plan was brilliant. Following her advice, I suggested to Richard only one deviation from his proposed plan. His idea was that once Harriet and Ida were dead, he would kill me and then himself. Naturally, as an authoritative man, accustomed to being in charge of whatever mattered to him, he wanted to be the one in control until the end. Nancy told me I had to persuade Richard that I should kill him rather than have him kill me. Impossible, I said. He will never agree. But Nancy said that he would if I approached him in the right way. I had to pretend to be more committed to our goal than he was. She was right. It worked. I went to Richard and said that it was not enough for the four of us to die. Me, him, Harriet, and Ida. Nancy had to be punished, too. I pretended that I would be happy to die only once she was dead. She was more evil than Harriet, I said. I related an elaborate tale of how Nancy callously plotted to seduce Patrick away from his wife and would not take no for an answer. I told Richard that she had confessed to me her true motive for speaking up at the King's Head was not to help Patrick, but to hurt Francis. She hoped that Francis would take her own life, or abandon Patrick at the very least, and return to her father in Cambridge, leaving the way clear for Nancy. More lies, said Poirot. Yes, of course more lies. But ones suggested to me by Nancy herself, and ones that did the trick. Richard agreed to die before me. And he did not know that Samuel Kidd was involved, did he? Said Poirot. No. Nancy and I brought Sam into it. He was part of our plan. Neither of us wanted to climb out of that window and down the tree. We both feared we would fall and break our necks. And after locking the door from the inside and hiding the key behind the tile, that was the only way to leave room 238. That's why Sam was needed. That and the impersonation of Richard. And the key had to be hidden behind the tile, I muttered to myself, checking I had it all straight in my mind. So that when you came to tell us your story, the one we heard at Mr. Kidd's house, it all appeared to fit. Richard Negus hid the key to make it look as if a murderer had taken it, because he was involved in a plan to frame Nancy Duquesne. Which he was, said Poirot, or rather, he thought he was. When Jenny handed him a glass of poisoned water, as agreed, he believed she would stay alive and do her best to ensure that Nancy was found guilty of the three Bloxham Hotel murders. He believed that she would speak to the police in such a way as to ensure that they suspected Nancy. He did not know that Nancy had arranged a cast-iron alibi with Lord and Lady St. John Wallace, or that after his death the cufflink would be pushed to the back of his mouth, the key hidden behind the tile, the window opened. He did not know that Jenny Hobbs, Nancy Duquesne, and Samuel Kidd would arrange it so that it appeared to the police that the killings must have taken place between 7:15 and 8:10. No. Richard was not privy to those details. Jenny agreed. Now can you see why I describe Nancy's plan as brilliant, Monsieur Poirot? She was a talented artist, mademoiselle. The best artists, they have the eye for detail and for structure. How all the components fit together. Jenny turned to me. Neither Nancy nor I wanted any of this. You have to believe me, Mr. Catchpool. Richard would have killed me if I had resisted him. She sighed. We had it all worked out. Nancy was supposed to get off scot-free, and Sam and I were to be punished for trying to frame Nancy, but not by death. A short term of imprisonment would suffice, we hoped, after which we intended to marry. Seeing our surprised faces, Jenny added, "Oh, I don't love Sam as I loved Patrick, but I am very fond of him. He would have made a good companion if I had not ruined it all by stabbing Nancy."
It was already ruined, mademoiselle. I knew that you had murdered Harriet Sipple and Richard Nicholls.
I did not murder Richard, Monsieur Poirot.
That's the one thing you're wrong about. Richard wanted to die. I gave him the poison with his full consent.
Yes, but under false pretenses.
Richard Nicholls agreed to die because you agreed to his plan that all four of you would die. Then it became five when you involved Nancy Duquesne. But you did not really agree. You betrayed him and plotted behind his back. Who knows whether Richard Nicholls would have chosen to die at that moment and in that way if you had told him the truth of your secret pact with Nancy Duquesne.
Jenny's expression hardened.
I did not murder Richard Nicholls. I killed him as an act of self-defense. He would have murdered me otherwise.
You said that he did not explicitly threaten this.
No, but I knew it. What do you think, Mr. Catchpool? Did I murder Richard Nicholls or not?
I don't know, I said, confused.
Catchpool, mon ami, do not be absurd.
He is not being absurd, said Jenny. He is using his brain where you refuse to, Monsieur Poirot. Please think about it, I beg of you. Before I hang, I hope to hear you say that I did not murder Richard Nicholls.
I stood up. Let us leave now, Poirot. I wanted to end the interview while the word hope still hung in the air. Epilogue. 4 days later, I was sitting in front of one of Blanche Unsworth's roaring fires, sipping a glass of brandy and working on my crossword puzzle, when Poirot walked into the drawing room. He stood silently by my side for several minutes. I did not look up. Eventually he cleared his throat.
Still, Catchpool, he said. Still, you avoid the discussion of whether or not Richard Nicholls was murdered, was assisted in taking his own life, or was killed in self-defense.
I hardly see that it would be a profitable debate, I said, as my stomach clenched. I did not want to talk about the Bloxham murders ever again. What I wanted, needed, was to write about them, to set down on paper every detail of what had happened. It mystified me that I was so eager to do the latter, and so reluctant to undertake the former. Why should writing about a thing be so different from speaking about it?
Do not alarm yourself, mon ami, said Poirot. I will not raise the matter again. We will talk of other things. For example, I visited Pleasance Coffee House this morning. Fee Spring asked me to pass the message to you that she would like to speak to you at your earliest convenience. She is displeased.
With me?
Yes. One moment, she says she is sitting in the Bloxham Hotel's dining room, hearing the explanation of everything, and the next, it is all over. A murder takes place in front of all our eyes, and the story, for our audience, is left incomplete. Mademoiselle Fee wishes you to relate the tale to her in its fullest form.
It's hardly my fault that there was another murder, I muttered under my breath. Can she not read the story in the newspapers like everybody else?
No, but she wishes to discuss it with you in particular. For a waitress, her intelligence is impressive. She is an estimable young woman.
Do you not think so, mon ami?
I know your game, Poirot, I said wearily. Really, you must desist. You are wasting your time, as is Fee Spring, assuming... Look, buzz off, can't you?
You are angry with me,
A little, yes, I admitted. Henry Negus in the suitcase, Raphael Bobak in the laundry cart, Thomas Brignall and his lady friend in the hotel garden, who happened to be wearing a light brown coat like half the women in England. The wheelbarrow. Ah. Yes, ah. You knew perfectly well that Jenny Hobbs wasn't dead, so why make such an effort to mislead me into suspecting that her body might have been removed from room 402 by three of the most unlikely means imaginable?
Because, my friend, I wanted to encourage you to imagine. If you do not consider the unlikeliest of possibilities, you will not be the best detective that you can be. It is the education for the little Graysales, to force them to move in unusual directions. From this comes the inspiration.
If you insist, I said doubtfully.
Poirot, he goes too far, you think, beyond what is necessary? Perhaps.
All that fuss you made about the trail of blood in room 402, leading from the pool of blood in the centre of the room towards the door, and all your exclaiming about the width of the doorway. What was that about? You knew that Jenny Hobbs had not been murdered and dragged anywhere.
I did, but you did not. You believed, as did our friend, Signor Lazari, that Mademoiselle Jenny was dead and that it was her blood on the floor.
Alors, I wanted you to demand of yourself.
A suitcase, a laundry cart on wheels, both of these are objects that could have been brought into room 402, right to the spot where the dead body was. Why, then, would a killer pull the body towards the door?
He would not. She would not. The trail of blood going in the direction of the door was a hoax. Its aim was to suggest to us that the body had been dragged out of the room, since it was not in the room.
It was the small detail of verisimilitude
so important to lend credence to the murder scene. But for Hercule Poirot, it was a detail that allowed him to know what he already strongly suspected. That Jenny Hobbs had not been murdered in that room, and neither had anybody else. I could imagine no method of removing a corpse that would necessitate the trail of blood smears going towards the door. No killer would take his victim's body out into the public corridor of a hotel without first hiding it in some sort of receptacle, a container. Every container I could think of could easily have been taken into the room, travelling towards the body rather than requiring the body to travel towards it. It was such simple logic, Cadgepole. I was surprised you did not grasp this point at once. Handy tip for you, Poirot, I said. Next time you'd like me to grasp something at once, open your mouth and tell me facts, whatever they are. Be straightforward about it. You'll find it saves a lot of bother. He smiled.
Bien. From my good friend Cadgepole, I shall endeavour to learn the comportement straightforward. I start immediately.
He produced an envelope from his pocket.
This arrived for me an hour ago.
You might not welcome my interference in your personal affairs, Cadgepole. You may think,
Poirot, he sticks in his oar where it is not wanted.
But this letter expresses gratitude for that very vice of mine that you find so intolerable. If you're referring to Fee Spring, she is not my personal affairs and never will be, I said, eyeing the missive in his hand. Which poor stick's private business have you meddled in now? And gratitude for what?
For bringing together two people who love each other very much.
Who is the letter from?
Poirot smiled. Doctor and Mrs. Ambrose Flowerday, he said. And he handed it to me to read. The end.
You've been listening to The Monogram Murders by Sophie Hannah, narrated by Julian Rind-Tutt.